If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and I'm very excited to tell you that the new season of Next Question is on its way. But to tide you over, I have the hottest ticket in town, and that's an interview with the one and only Michael Lewis. You know him. You love him. You've heard of all of his books like The Blind Side, Moneyball, The Big Short. Well, now he's got a new one out. And his timing, can I say, could not be better. It's called Going Infinite: The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. Here is our conversation. I had so much fun talking to Michael Lewis. Now I understand crypto a little bit better, and I hope you all have as much fun listening to our conversation. Here it is. Hello. How are you?
I really underdressed.
Oh, no, but you're good. You're good. You can relax. So should we go, you guys? Are we ready? Okay. All right. Wow. Michael Lewis, how many books have you written, by the way?
I don't know.
I looked it up, and it kept going and going and going and going.
It's just, I don't know. The distinction needs to be made. There's a list there in the front of the this book. Some of them are books, and some of them are book-like objects.
What do you mean?
So it's one thing to sit down like this and plot, create, structure a whole book. And it's another to write 4 magazine articles and put them together in a book. And so Boomerang or The Fifth Risk or The Money Culture, those are all, I'll defend them, but they are book-like objects, not books.
All right. I have 16, I counted.
No, there's 16 things.
Yes. Well, 16, I think most of these were books.
Yeah, 16 items, and I bet 6 of them were book-like objects.
Really?
Yes.
Well, talk about the stars aligning. Your book is coming out at the same time Sam Bankman-Fried is on trial.
Yep.
I mean, did you all plan this? Was this serendipitous? How did this happen?
We kind of planned it. I started writing this thing at the end of January, and I know it usually takes me 6 months once I've got all my stuff. And so I knew when I'd have it finished. So they knew when they arranged. They knew it was coming out in the fall. But then they announced the trial date, and it made sense. Oddly, the trial was supposed to start Monday, but the judge had some personal reason he wanted to start it Tuesday. So he actually the book was launched on the day of the trial. So it's part of me, it kills me that I'm not there, because I've seen the list of the prosecutor's witnesses who they're likely to call, and it maps very closely on the characters in the book. So it'd be like watching, characters from a novel come to life or something like that. Feels like that.
We're going to get into the intricacies a little bit simplified of the trial and the crimes, et cetera. But I want to go back to the beginning, Michael, because you're almost a literary anthropologist. I find your book so interesting because I think, in fairness, I saw this on 60 Minutes, but you take a character and that character becomes emblematic of another big issue. Mm. And you met with this young man more than 100 times over 2 years. Mm-hmm. So if you had to use one word to describe what your experience, what your time was like with SBF, as he's called, what word would that be?
I'm going to choose a strange one, satiric, in that right from the beginning, he struck me as walking social satire. He'd gone from zero to having $22 billion in about 18 months, and all of society had reorganized itself around this pile of money. And everywhere he goes, what is either happening to him or his observations, because he's a Martian. He comes from another planet and he sees the world in just a different way. it felt like social satire. So satiric. It felt, I mean, this is going to sound very odd given these circumstances. It was funny. I mean, it was funny and sad. It, you know, funny and sad go together, but there was a lot of funny. And so satiric, that's the thing that comes.
And surreal, and something that almost sounds like the pages of a Tom Wolfe novel, honestly. So I just watched a documentary about Tom Wolfe. You're heavily featured. I loved it, by the way. It was based on your profile of Tom Wolfe in Vanity Fair. And, you know, as I read about Sam, I thought, whoa, this is the kind of thing Tom Wolfe, the kind of person Tom Wolfe would have been all over. Do you agree?
I agree, especially early Wolfe. He wrote these pieces that were fabulous about Silicon Valley people.
Right.
Before the internet, right? It was like the semiconductor people. It was like these people are of the moment and they're changing the culture in some way. Also, the Merry Pranksters, that crowd. I mean, this is a version of the Merry Pranksters. I mean, these people who are rolling through the world just creating disruption wherever they go. He would have been drawn to Sam Bankman-Fried. So yes, I think that's completely true.
Do you think that SBF represents capitalism at its worst in a way?
It represents capitalism at its most chaotic. And there's a reason for that. He was drawn to chaos. When he figured out that he excelled relative to other people in these semi-chaotic environments where his mathy brain still was useful, but he needed it to be really messy at the same time. It couldn't be orderly, couldn't be structured, couldn't be perfectly predictable. When he figured that out on Wall Street when he's 21 years old, he then proceeds to create those environments in which he'll succeed.
So he thrives in chaos.
He thrives in mess and chaos, and he knows that everybody else doesn't. So at some level, and so he feels most comfortable when that's the environment. He's also capitalism at its most current. I mean, if you think about history, just put him in some sort of historical context. You think, oh, this is just how it is now. Mark Zuckerberg is a bit like this. He came out of nowhere and had billions of dollars instantly. But that doesn't really happen in history. Like most people who got this rich, they had to like dig oil out of ground,
right?
Build railroads, build stuff, build companies. This instant acquisition of a fortune is so peculiarly of now. And what's so, one among the things that's so odd about it is that the person who in possession of the fortune is a stranger to the world. Like nobody knows who they are. He goes from being nobody who, and he has no social relations kind of thing, to being at the center of some universe instantly before anybody has a chance to figure out, should he be, you know? So that's a curious feature of modern capitalism, I think.
So you meet this guy, you guys take a walk, you take a hike in California. Tell me, what was your first impression?
First impression was, there's a kind of artlessness about him and an openness and a willingness to talk about things that normally people just wouldn't be easy talking about, like how much money he had, where it had come from, how crazy it was he had it, that his parents didn't know what to make of it because they were two professors at Stanford and he was raised not caring about money. And so first impression was very, he was also very peculiar, that he was disheveled. When he came out, he always looks like he just fell out of a dumpster, right? I mean, he's got
he looks like an unmade bed.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah, an unmade bed on top of an unmade bed. He looks, and it was the total absence of interest in his own appearance, the total in his headness. So normally when you meet somebody, it's an exchange, right? They ask questions about you. You ask questions about them.
Let me guess. He asked you no questions.
Zero. I'm going to tell you something. 2 years later, he's still not asked me any questions. So as far as I know, he knows nothing about me and knows nothing about what I was writing about. But he never asked me, like, what's the book going to look like? Nothing. So it was all one way.
It's so interesting because he's this odd combination, and we'll talk about this in a moment, too. I don't want to get too ahead of myself. An incredible desire to do good without any emotional intelligence.
Yeah, that's true.
Like this strange combination.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about his childhood. As you mentioned, his parents were two Stanford law professors who I guess are having their own legal problems right now, right? I mean, they've been sued for their involvement in this whole enterprise. But tell us about where he grew up, what his life was like, And I'm curious about the nurture nature aspect of him. Help us understand him.
His parents, both tax law professors at Stanford.
That sounds boring.
Yeah. Well, unless that's your cup of tea, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And the kind
you're
of person for whom that's like a cup of tea is a different kind of person. They like to live in their head. And tax law does get to kind of like structure of society questions, like how you distribute wealth. And it isn't just like
what numbers.
It isn't just numbers. It's ideas. They're two people who live for ideas.
To all the tax lawyers out there, I deeply apologize.
Do I need to? I
mean,
no, okay.
You're defending them and saying it's ideas.
But they sat in the middle of actually a pretty active, interesting social circle. They were very social people. Their dinner parties on Sunday nights were famous on the Stanford campus. Their son struck even their friends as peculiar right from the beginning. And one comment that stuck with me is one of the distinguished guests at the Sunday night dinner party said he always thought that the parents were afraid for and of Sam. Like they were worried about where he was going to end up in the world because he didn't make social connections. He was so isolated as a kid. And the feeling of his childhood to me, talking to him and to those around him, was that he was just waiting for it to end, that he was waiting for everybody else to grow up around him so that he would have people to talk to because he did not ever connect to peers. He had one friend, and the one friend was a child of his parents' friend. So they were kind of put together that way. And they were connected through this game they played called Magic the Gathering, which is a complicated, it's a messy, chaos, but mathy card game. And they didn't really have to talk about much because they just played cards together the whole time. So it's an unusual childhood. I mean, I asked.
But it doesn't sound necessarily unhappy, just different.
You know, I kept coming back to this. It sounds sad, but he's not sad. It sounds almost tragic. He didn't feel tragic. He felt like he was living in his own head and trying to make sense of the world around him in his own peculiar way. So verbally facile and so interested in the world around him that...
And yet never asked you a question.
Never
asked me a question. So that doesn't really jibe.
Yeah, no, it doesn't jibe, but he's interested in ideas.
We'll be back with more of Michael Lewis right after this.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
We're back with author Michael Lewis. Let's talk about his sort of raison d'etre. So he had a dream, and that was to make a shitload of money and give it away, something that's called effective altruism, which actually I hadn't heard of before. I mean, I know the idea of it,
right. You
know, but I'd never heard of that term. Yeah.
Movement is fascinating.
And well, tell me about the movement and how he got sucked into it.
Right. So there's a whole intellectual prehistory we don't need to get into. The modern version of it is Oxford professors, 2008-ish or so, start to make an argument that very little cost to yourself, you middle-class English person, could give away money so effectively that, you know, what might cost you a cup of coffee saves a life in Africa. So how can you possibly buy that cup of coffee for yourself if you could save a life in Africa with that same money? And they actually start to make the calculations on their own salaries. Like if we take everything but what we absolutely need to live on, what over our lifetimes, what could we accomplish? And it was like, we save 80,000 African children from blindness. There's some numbers like that. And they start to kind of put these ideas out to young people, actually kind of almost like you build a religion or a cult.
When does this whole movement start?
About 2008, 2009. But by 2012, when one of these philosophers, named Will McGaskill, gives a talk that Sam hears at MIT. It's in Cambridge, at Harvard, but he was at MIT. McGaskill is morphed a little bit. The movement morphs a few times, but this big morph was, the idea was, all right, you kid, you could go become a doctor and go to Africa. And in your lifetime, you would save 200 people's lives. Or you could go work at a high-frequency trading firm on Wall Street and make lots of money and pay 50 doctors to go to Africa and save 50 times the number of lives. So the idea is earn to give. And that's the idea that animates Sam. It's like, up to that point, money's not on his radar screen. It's not like, I didn't really care about it, doesn't think about it. He's a kid of two professors at Stanford who probably thinks he's going to become a professor. Now, where the movement gets really a little out there is right after he gets into it, it morphs again. And they start to argue about like the math of saving lives. And yeah, you could give your dollars to save that kid's life in Africa, but those same dollars could be given to reduce certain existential risks to humanity. A pandemic that wipes out the species, AI out of control, climate change, risk of nuclear war. And if you could do anything to tilt the odds against all future human beings being wiped out, the math suggests you should do that rather than save living, breathing ones now.
So it swings to prevention.
To prevention. That's to prevention of a thing that's going to be very hard to know whether you succeeded or not, you know, because what you're trying to do is stop something from happening.
Right.
So all of a sudden, there's a reason not to make just a few million, that this is like unlimited sums of money. Infinite money is what we need. And that's the climate in which Sam comes of age and develops his own life ambition.
So he wants more and more and more and more for good.
And is that more and more and more and more, not just more and more and more and more, but the 20 billionth dollar or the trillionth dollar is as valuable as the 999 billionth dollar. That it's just like there's no diminishing returns. It's
so
sort
that,
of like,
that captures his attention, gives him purpose, and he settles on two causes. Pandemic prevention, which you mentioned, and then protecting democracy.
So that's controversial, right? He has these effective altruists. It is a movement. There are thousands of people involved in it. It has certain cult-like qualities, but it's also kind of like an anti-cult because they're all into argument and reason. So the movement can change. Like someone makes a better argument and it goes a different direction. And Sam makes a new argument that actually irritates all the effective altruists. It's that in addition to climate change, AI, pandemics, asteroids, whatever, Donald Trump should be on that list.
Right. Well, basically, his argument is that you need government. Government is essential. And this is, of course, arguable and debatable. But government is essential to solve some of the most intractable societal problems. So we have to protect government. We have to protect democracy. And that means basically neutralizing Donald Trump at any cost.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right?
Yes, yes. It's sort of like if American democracy fails, democracy is going to fail. And democracy is the best tool for addressing these problems. And so Donald Trump his name has been added to this list of existential risks to humanity.
And he, in fact, offers $50 billion to—
Five.
Yeah, $50 billion would be pretty hard to resist, wouldn't it? But $5 billion to Donald Trump to not run for president of the United States, which apparently gets some traction. Did he meet with people high up in his circle?
Sam? So the way Sam's, best I can tell, political operation worked is it essentially had two almost identical parts, one Republican, one Democrat. He hired a bunch of Republicans in one silo and a bunch of Democrats in the other and funded them both. And in the Republican silo, I do know that the people there met with people very close to Trump. I do know that happened.
So how did Sam Bankman-Fried make so much money? Everyone thinks he's going to be the world's first trillionaire. Let's break down what he was doing for the Bitcoin Challenged, I Among Them, which I now understand more having read your book and read a lot of articles about this. But think of this as cryptocurrency for dummies. What exactly is cryptocurrency?
It's made up money. So it is an idea that is hatched by someone, we don't know who he is, but his pseudonym was Satoshi Nakamoto in 2008. And the idea is a means of exchange, a form of payment, a store of value that is not sourced by the government. It doesn't come out of the government. It's just like this thing we're going to...
Digital currency.
Digital currency. It's a string of digits. And we're going to say, this is valuable. And it's valuable if people believe it's valuable. And when it starts, it seems preposterous. Like, why would anybody want a Bitcoin? It turns out it's not preposterous. Why would people want a Bitcoin? There ends up being an answer to the question. People who are kind of suspicious of governments, of institutions, of banks, people who want to hold wealth in ways that are hard to detect, people who want to make payments without anybody knowing what they've done, that Bitcoin catches on with a kind of a smallish group of people who have got a religious fervor about it, and it's mostly kind of libertarian types. When Bitcoin starts to go up in price, in the first place, there's only one digital currency. It's just Bitcoin. In the end, there are now thousands of them.
Right.
And to
starts as an investor and then figures out there's got to be a way to build a better mousetrap. He creates a platform called FTX,
you can think of that as the cryptocurrency casino.
Right.
And just to sort of ease your anxiety about all this, he didn't know about cryptocurrency. He didn't care about it. I mean, there's a technology underneath it that would take a long time to explain. And every time I think I understand it, I come back and I think I actually didn't understand that as well as I should. He didn't care about any of that. It was just a thing that went up and down like tulip bulbs in price, and then he could buy and sell. That's how he gets in. And he never really has to understand a whole lot more. But what he does see when he gets in is that the exchanges, like the New York Stock Exchange, but they're versions of the New York Stock Exchange for cryptocurrencies, where you can go and buy and sell cryptocurrencies. And those exchanges, a lot of them were kind of flawed. They were risky to trade on. Sometimes they lost everybody's money. And he realized that if you created a better exchange, you could own the casino.
Right.
And if you own the casino, the way you get paid is every time someone comes and makes a bet, you take a little piece of it. You get a fee for every bet that gets made. And so ultimately, they're $250 billion a month being traded on his exchange, FTX, and he takes out a tiny percentage, but it ends up being a lot of money.
Right.
So much money that in 2021, they have $1 billion in revenues, $400 million in profits, and venture capitalists are investing in him at a rate that suggests the company's worth $40 billion. And this happens in a matter of 18 months from the time he creates it in early 2019.
But he had two companies, so he establishes FTX, but the first company he built was called Alameda Research. And that's where the trouble began.
So he starts his own little trading firm, Alameda. Then he starts out of that, this exchange. And Alameda is just one of the traders on the exchange. The problem was when he started FTX, he couldn't get bank accounts, like dollar bank accounts, for FTX. So if you, Katie, wanted to put your money on FTX to start to buy cryptocurrencies, there was no account at FTX you could wire your dollars to or bring your dollars
right.
to that would hold the dollars that could then be turned into cryptocurrency. I mean, you physically couldn't turn up, right? You can go find them in Hong Kong. You got to wire some money into account. And the money is government money. It's euros or dollars or it's yen. It starts that way. And so people wanted to wire their money onto FTX. FTX didn't have any bank accounts because banks didn't want to bank crypto exchanges, but they would bank Sam's original trading business. And so in the beginning, you would wire your money to Alameda in order to get it FTX. And I mean, that was already balky. Like, that's weird. And it's amazing that people did $8.8 billion turn up that way and nobody asked any questions. And I've seen the statements. It says, you think you're wiring it to FTX, but it actually says Alameda on it or some other Alameda subsidiary. But what should have happened is once FTX got bank accounts or once it got turned into crypto, that it be held in either crypto wallets or in FTX bank accounts and be completely separate from Sam's trading fund. And it never was. So that's not the only way the customer's money ended up in Alameda, but it's the main way. And one can speculate about how and why it didn't ever get moved over, like that chunk of money. You know, I have my theories, but they're unfounded. And Sam's story is that by the time they got bank accounts for FTX, the kind of pool of money that had piled up inside of Alameda was such a small fraction of what was in Alameda.
$8 billion?
Eight out of 100. So, you know, that it was just sort of like he wasn't even thinking about it. That's his story. The other thing is Sam is different. And so he's capable of thinking things that I wouldn't think. And he was capable of a radical sloppiness with money that I just wouldn't be capable of. But if it were me and I was thinking I have sinister intent or I just don't care about my customer, I would think, well, they'll never know and it's a free loan. Because that's how it functioned, right? It's sort of like the customer's money is in the private hedge fund and no one's paying interest on it. It's a free loan. And that's how it looks to most people.
When it all falls apart, how much money just vanished into thin air?
This is a great question. When the customers all come for their money at once.
There's a run on the platform.
There's a run on the on Sam's World. There's about $15 billion that should have been there. When they stop paying people back, there's about $10 billion that's still missing. So $5 billion got paid back. And then so the customers are out 10. What we now know is it was actually, so the bankruptcy people have announced these numbers. There's now $8.6 billion of customers' deposits. Like customers are waiting to get their $8.6 billion back. But against that, the bankruptcy people have already found $7.3 billion in liquid assets. So the hole right there is $1.3 billion. It looks like just went poof. However, in addition, in Sam's World, there were all these investments made that are not liquid assets. They're investments in weird companies, startup companies. And at least one of those investments is clearly worth more than $1 billion. One out of a pile of 300. It's an investment in an artificial intelligence company called Anthropic. So it is conceivable that nothing went poof. It's conceivable that the customers will all get 100 cents on the dollar back and that what they will have suffered was the inconvenience of waiting for it. And it may be years, it may be 2 or 3 years.
I was going to say conceivable, but likely? I mean, who knows?
So it seems very possible that people will all get their money back, which would be very Sam Bankman-Fried. It's sort of like this huge mess, this huge drama, this huge, like, social convulsion. And in the end, it's a shaggy dog story.
But meanwhile, he could spend the rest of his life in prison.
He could.
Right? I mean, whether people get their money back or not.
That's right,
Michael?
Yep, that's
so
right.
So what charges is he facing?
This is what I've been told by a former prosecutor who now is a defense attorney, but she worked in this office as prosecuting him, that I'm told, oddly, that there are no federal statutes about theft. You can't just charge him with stealing people's money. The laws that do exist are by using the federal mails, using the internet to facilitate a theft. So he's charged with wire fraud, with money laundering, with bank fraud. He's not charged with theft, which is what really is the problem is here. So they're complicated charges. There are 7 of them, I think. They tried to throw in some more, but they weren't able to do it. And when you add up all the charges and the kind of sentences that attach to those charges, he's facing 120 years in jail. But then, so first the jury will decide, convict or acquit. If they acquit, he's off. But if they convict, the judge decides the sentence. And the judge can do anything from just let him go. I mean, like a day of house arrest or something, to 120 years in jail. And I suspect this judge, who has become so irritated with Sam, he can't even look at him. Sam, under house arrest, has not been the best behaved defendant, that the sentence was going to be heavy. So I don't know. I think he's very likely going to go to jail. It's possible. You never know what a jury is going to do, that he won't, but he's very likely to go to jail. And what happens to him then? I don't know. I said this on 60 Minutes, and it was a joke, kind of, but I think
But I heard you said he'd be happier in prison with the internet than in a beautiful
penthouse
with no Wi-Fi.
Exactly. And he apparently saw the 60 Minutes show in jail, and he apparently told his lawyers that's true.
You know, he was surrounded by a lot of it people. Nothing says I want to be your friend like someone with a lot of money, right? I mean, you talked about Anna Wintour doing a Zoom. He got Tom Brady to promote FTX, Steph Curry, Shaquille O'Neal, Larry David got paid $10 million to do that Super Bowl commercial. They spent, $25 million on that commercial?
Great ad.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was a funny ad. Anything Larry David does is funny to me. But do they have any culpability? They're promoting this unregulated platform. They're vouching in essence for this kid and what he's created. And a lot of people admire them and listen to them and then invested in crypto. I mean, I'm just curious.
What do you think?
I don't think they will, but I wonder if they should.
Everybody was so all in on Sam Bankman-Fried, it would have been unusual for someone not to take the money. And it wasn't just...
That's when you need Warren Buffett, right?
Yes, that's right. And it wasn't... this is going to sound odd. It wasn't just the money. I mean, many of these people could get their money from a lot of different places. A bit more money than they might have gotten from other places, but they really liked him. They really liked him. And
now, can you understand that?
Yes.
After spending all that time with him.
Because he's so different from anyone they knew, and he didn't behave the way people behave around celebrities.
But such a one-way relationship. Like, do you think he ever asked Tom Brady a question?
No. People wanted to hear what he had to say.
And he was the new
thing. He was the new thing. He was the new thing. And it wasn't that this money was falling off him. That was part of it. But it wasn't just that. And it was like...
Well, it was also that he understood this world that nobody else did in a way.
That's true. He was explaining crypto. But tell you what the other thing was, he is a response. If you look at the rise of Sam Bankman-Fried and what are the ingredients... The decline of institutional authority in the world, the decline of government's ability to do anything about anything. People are so sick of it. Like, why can't we address climate change? Why can't these problems be? And people are defaulting to looking to people. And he seemed actually sincere in his desire to fix these problems. And people wanted him to exist. People wanted there to be a Sam. And you saw that. It was palpable. It was not just greed. It was more than that. It was complicated.
When we come back, I'm going to finish things up by talking with Michael about a personal tragedy his family experienced. That's right after this.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
We're back with more of my conversation with Michael Lewis. We only have 5 minutes. Can I ask you just some general questions about your career, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
One of your former subjects, Billy Beane, of course, from Moneyball, he once said you have a horseshoe. This is a funny quote, a horseshoe in your underwear when it comes to finding a good story. I mean, you do seem to really be able to.
I'm sorry, Katie. That's not a horseshoe.
Okay. How do you find these good stories, Michael?
I just wonder. There's no science to it. I just wonder. I mean, Sam Bankman-Fried collides with me, right? But here's what helps. Not thinking you know what the story is. Not prejudging. Not trying to impose order too early on what you're seeing. Just feeling like this is interesting and I want more of it.
And I want to see what happens. And having the luxury, to be honest with you, to spend 2 years.
But then there's a risk. I mean, I got to November of last year and I wasn't sure I had a book. I was having arguments with friends about whether they were arguing with me, like, you should do it. And I was saying, I'm not sure. I don't know where it's going. And that has happened to me, that I get stuck in something for a while and it doesn't yield anything. But I've marinated it for a year. And where did that year go? But that is, it's just sort of like, if I'm interested, genuinely interested, not trying to like force some idea upon the world, and I let that interest just flow over me, it eventually leads somewhere good. And what's going on is if I'm interested, really interested, the reader will be interested. And if I'm not interested, the reader's going to be bored.
But I think also you're able to marry personality with complicated topics, with sort of social impact, and you're able to weave them all together in a way that's understandable and entertaining. And I think that's your gift, Michael. Meanwhile, congratulations for selling Going Infinite for 5 million clams to Apple.
Do you believe the numbers you read in the newspaper?
Is that not true?
Well, it's never, you know, they have to make the movie, there's incentives, there's that kind of stuff.
But yeah it's a nice chunk of change, Michael.
I
hope.
It makes my horseshoe look even bigger.
I love talking to you. You're such a fun interview, and you're heading out. But okay. I just want to say one thing before you leave. I just want you to know that you and Tabitha and your family have been in my thoughts so much.
Thanks.
Since you lost your daughter, Dixie, and her boyfriend in a car accident. I read that, Michael, and I was honestly, it was from afar crushing. I know that.
You know what pain is.
I do, but losing a child, I think, is indescribable and unparalleled pain. Mm. And, you know, I know Tabitha a little bit from when she was on NBC and always really liked her. And I'm just so sorry for your loss. And I'm glad that you are moving forward because, you know, I always think we're all terminal. Like, we just have to make the most of the time we have. And, I just wanted you to know that you and your family, your two other kids, Quinn and Walker, right?
Right. Yep.
I've just been holding you all in my heart.
Thank you. She's alive in me. She's with me. So she's in this book in a funny way. So yeah, I thank you.
By the way, everybody, if you just can't get enough of Sam Bankman-Fried, Michael is going to be doing a podcast called Judging Sam, chronicling the trial with a different guest every week. So check it out. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have a question for me, a subject you want us to cover, or you want to share your thoughts about how you navigate this crazy world, reach out. You can leave a short message at 609-512-5505, or you can send me a DM on Instagram. I would love to hear from you. Next Question is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. Our supervising producer is Marcy Thompson. Our producers are Adriana Fazio and Catherine Law. Our audio engineer is Matt Russell, who also composed our theme music. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to the description in the podcast app or visit us at katiecouric.com. You can also find me on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.